Welcome, everyone. I call to order a meeting of the Senate Committee on Workforce. Today is Wednesday, February 8th, 2017. We have a few housekeeping things to take care of before we get started, so just a moment here. I'm going to go ahead and open a work session for the purpose of introducing committee measures. As a reminder, a vote to introduce a measure does not designate support for the substance of the measure. It only serves to allow the proposal to be introduced.
Chair Taylor, I move that LC 984, dated 11-3-16, be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Knope moves that LC 984, dated 11-3-16, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion?
No, I'm fine.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, LC 984 is introduced as a committee bill. Gavel. And we will go ahead and close the work session. I am opening an informational hearing on legislative issues concerning the Oregon Public Employees Retirement System. So, ladies and gentlemen, so first I'd like to welcome Senator Johnson.
Thank you very much for the courtesy you're extending, Madam Chair.
Yes, she's going to join us on the committee and listen in. She's been very involved in working with PERS, and so we welcome Senator Johnson's today. This is our third informational hearing in the committee's conversation about PERS. We heard an overview of the system by PERS Executive Director Steve Rodman, who's over here to my right, and we heard about the permissible scope of legislative actions on PERS under Supreme Court rulings from Legislative Counsel Marissa James. Today we'll hear more about the issues that the legislature has considered to date and different perspectives on where it should go from here. So I'm going to go ahead and call Bill Gary up to the dais here to speak with us. He's an attorney at Heron Long Gary Rudnick, and who's represented the Oregon local governments in connection with PERS reform and the litigation since 1996. So I'm going to go ahead and call Mr. Gary up. Just for a little context, folks, is that Mr. Gary is going to speak for about a half hour, and then after that, another attorney, Mr. Greg Hartman, is going to speak. And these two gentlemen, for those who do not know, were for the Morrow case, with the most recent significant PERS case that came before the state that went to the Supreme Court. These two gentlemen were the attorneys, shall we say, on two opposing sides. And so they are both experts in this area. This is why we've asked them to come and talk to us about this. The Morrow decision is a very significant decision and about what decisions can be made by the legislature in regard to PERS. There's a lot of restrictions due to the Morrow decision. And as always, this is very, very complex, and this has been going on for a lot of PERS discussions for almost three decades. And so these two gentlemen have very kindly agreed to come and talk to us about what happened during the Morrow case and lessons that we can learn from that. So thank you so much for coming. We have not met before, but I really appreciate you coming to Salem. So,
Madam Chair, may I just
Yes.
I may have the get called to go testify on another bill, so if I leave right in the middle of one of the attorney's presentations, not because I'm upset with them, I got to run out real quick, and I'll be back.
Thank you, Senator Hansel. I can attest that Senator Hansel is one of my favorite colleagues, and he would never just leave because he's a very polite man and would never just get up and leave, but I appreciate you clarifying that. So go ahead and turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is William Gary. I am an attorney, and I currently represent the Oregon School Boards Association and their constituents, and probably some other local governments as well, on matters related to PERS. As the chair indicated, I've been at PERS-related legislation and litigation for more than 20 years. I have been fighting with my friend and colleague, Mr. Hartman, for most of those years, although he reminded me this afternoon that back in 1996 we were on the same side. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about the state of the law concerning PERS as you wade into your legislative work. The challenge you face in forging consensus on legislative changes in PERS is a little bit like playing three-dimensional chess. There's the public policy dimension. How can you deliver the most essential public services at a sustainable cost to taxpayers while treating public employees fairly and maintaining generational equity? There's the political dimension, in which you must somehow forge agreement in a superheated and contentious environment. Dealing with these two challenges is just another day at the office for members of the Oregon legislature. But when it comes to PERS, you must also contend with a legal dimension in which you must make sense of complex, confusing, and sometimes inconsistent court decisions. You'll hear conflicting opinions about what the law requires or permits, and if you're successful in taking action, only then will the Supreme Court grade your paper, and they will use an answer key that only the Supreme Court possesses. The good news on the legal front is that the Supreme Court's 2016 decision in Morrow versus the State of Oregon, reviewing the most recent legislative effort at PERS reform, brought a measure of clarity to the legislature's power to change PERS. As a general rule, and subject to one important exception, PERS can be changed prospectively. You have the power to make even sweeping changes to PERS, so long as those changes do not affect benefits that already have been earned for work that already has been performed. The bad news is that this clarity about the law comes 20 years too late. Much of the actuarial liability that drives the cost of the system is tied to benefits that already have been earned for work that already has been performed. That cost is baked in. Your ability to reduce costs is limited to making prospective changes that will reduce the cost of the system going forward. That does not mean, as some have suggested, that there is nothing that can be done about the cost of PERS. Senate Bills 559 and 560, in my view, are two examples of lawful changes that would result in real savings. But it does mean that the range of options is narrow, and the amount of potential savings that you can achieve is diminishing by the day. So how did we get here? There's never really been a serious dispute about the fact that some PERS statutes create statutory contractual promises and contract rights on the part of PERS members. Nor has there ever been much doubt that the courts will step in to protect those contract rights if the legislature attempts to take them away. What Mr. Hartman and I and many others have been fighting over for the past 20 years has been exactly what those contracts are. What is the content of the contractual promises, and what is the extent to which those promises are carved in stone, thereby tying the legislature's hands if it tries to change them? Most of you recognize that your power to enact laws is limited to the sessions in which you serve, and future legislatures retain the power to make changes to any of the laws that you pass. Statutory contractual promises are a notable but very narrow and limited exception to that general principle that the legislature's hands are not tied. In 1994, Oregon voters adopted ballot measure 8, a measure that was sponsored in principal part by Bill Sizemore, and it made a series of very significant changes to PERS. Public employees challenged those changes on a number of different grounds, and the challenges made their way to the Supreme Court. In a case called Oregon State Police Officers Association, or OSPOA, versus the State of Oregon, decided in 1996, the Supreme Court invalidated all of ballot measure 8 on the ground that it violated the contract rights of PERS members. The court held that each of the statutes that ballot measure 8 changed were a part of the PERS contract, and it held that neither the legislature nor the people could change those provisions. Significantly, the court in OSPOA held not only that those provisions were unchangeable with respect to benefits that had been already earned for work that had already been performed, it also held that they could not be changed prospectively with respect to work that was to be performed in the future. Under OSPOA, once a PERS member began working for a PERS employer, the terms of the PERS contract, whatever they may be, could not be changed, at least could not be diminished in terms of the rights given to the PERS members, as long as the member continued to work for a PERS-covered employer. The OSPOA contract court reasoned that PERS is what lawyers call a unilateral contract, as distinguished from a bilateral contract. It's not that complicated. A unilateral contract is where one person makes an offer to another that can only be accepted by the other doing an act, doing the performance. The example that I learned in law school was called the Brooklyn Bridge hypothetical. I say to you, I will give you $100 if you'll walk across the Brooklyn Bridge. The law says that's a unilateral contract because the only way you can accept my offer is to actually perform, to walk across the bridge. The court, the law also says that because you have to accept by performance, the general rule that I can revoke my offer at any time doesn't apply to unilateral contracts. I have to give you a reasonable opportunity to perform. So I can't wait until you've walked halfway across the Brooklyn Bridge and yell to you, I revoke my offer. I have to leave it open until you've had a chance to complete performance. In OSPOA, the court said that's the way PERS works. If you say to someone, if you work for me, I will give you retirement benefits that look like this when you retire, you have to make those benefits available for the entire time that that person works for you. OSPOA was a significant departure from mainstream legal thought about how pensions work. The rule under ERISA, the federal law applicable to private pensions, was and is that an employer can change the terms of a pension prospectively, but it cannot do so in a way that affects benefits that have already been earned for work that has already been performed. And that's been the rule applicable in most states with respect to public pensions as well. That was the rule that PERS employers, including my clients, advocated, but OSPOA rejected it. In the 1990s, the PERS board made a series of earning crediting decisions that I'm sure you've heard about that caused benefits and costs to and employer contributions to soar. The PERS contract assured members that their accounts would grow by at least the assumed earnings rate every year. In the 90s, that rate was 8%. And the board would credit at least 8% every year. In years during the 90s when the stock market was gaining at a rate of 20 or 25%, the PERS board credited much more than 8%, sometimes 20%, and did so rather than putting that money aside to cover the cost of the 8% guarantee in years when the stock market earned less than 8%. As a result, the money match benefit calculation became the dominant method of calculating pensions, and the growth of member accounts sent benefits and costs through the roof. The courts ultimately held that the overcrediting that took place in the 1990s was unlawful, but the problem still remained. And in 2003, the legislature was faced with the challenge of bringing PERS costs under control. Because of OSPOA, the legislators, the governor, and the stakeholders who had an interest in PERS reform focused not on making prospective changes to the existing system, but rather focused on asking, well, what is part of the contract? Because the court had made it clear that not every statute relating to PERS was a part of the contract. And so it made a series of decisions, including the centerpiece of the 2003 legislation, which seems counterintuitive, but actually makes sense and had a positive effect. And that is that the legislature directed that members would no longer contribute 6% of their incomes to PERS, to their PERS member account, which was growing at the rate of 8% per year. But instead, that money would be sent to what's called the individual account program, a separate 401k type program that earned interest, earned earnings on the investment, but there was no guarantee of a return, and it didn't inflate the money match benefit. That change, even though it created yet another retirement benefit for PERS members, had the effect that it was intended to have and reduced the growth by which the cost of PERS was increasing. In Strunk versus PERB, the Supreme Court dealt with the PERS reforms of 2003. It invalidated some provisions, but it upheld the individual account program provision that I just described. The court in Strunk criticized the holding in OSPOA, but it did not overrule it. By 2013, the legislature was again faced with escalating PERS costs and a narrowing field of things that could be done legally to reduce those costs. Because so much of the cost that they were facing was already baked in, affected retirees as well as senior people in government, Tier 1 members who were nearing retirement and had earned much of their benefit already, the legislature in 2013 and 2014 focused on attempting to stop the growth of pensions for people who had already retired or who had already earned a significant pension. And they did that by attacking the cost of living adjustment statute and reducing significantly the cost of living that would be paid to PERS members after they retired. Typically, it ran 2% per month. The legislature's ultimate decision and what was called the grand bargain at the time was to reduce that to, I believe it was 1.25% on the first $60,000 of PERS benefits, and reduce it even more to 0.25% on pensions above $60,000 per year. Morrow went to the Supreme Court challenging that decision, and on the ground that it was an impairment of the contract rights of PERS members. And the court concluded, and the state and local governments argued that the cost of living adjustment, because of its peculiar history in PERS, wasn't a part of the contract. It was simply a benefit that the legislature had conferred, but they did not make a contractual promise that it would never change. The Supreme Court in Morrow rejected that contention. They just didn't agree that the legislature had not intended to make a statutory contractual promise. And so they said the changes are invalid. But the legislature didn't stop, the Supreme Court didn't stop there. They could have simply done what the court had done in OSPOA and say those changes are invalid, go back to the way it was before. But instead, they overruled OSPOA. They said OSPOA was no longer good law because it had been wrongly decided, and they held that the COLA changes were invalid only insofar as they applied COLAs for the benefits that already had been earned, and for benefits that had already been earned for work that had already been performed. But they said they were valid as to benefits that will be earned in the future. Now, from a cost standpoint, the decision in Morrow was a disaster in terms of the cost of PERS. It wiped out most of the savings that would have been realized if the COLA law had been allowed to go into effect fully. But in terms of analysis, the change was significant. It overturned OSPOA with respect to the ability of the legislature to make changes prospectively. And it did, an outstanding job of explaining why they thought that OSPOA had been wrongly decided. They pointed out that the Brooklyn Bridge hypothetical was inapt because, unlike the Brooklyn Bridge hypothetical, where you'll only get $100 if you walk all the way across the bridge, PERS members are earning benefits that become vested and accrued every day that they go to work. And so it was more like a hypothetical where I say to you, if you'll walk across the Brooklyn Bridge, I will pay you a dollar for every step that you take. If you walk 10 steps, you've earned $10. If you walk all the way across the bridge, you've earned a dollar for every step that you took. In that situation, there's no need for the law to require that you hold the offer open until performance is completed, because the person performing the contract is receiving benefits as they go. And they likened PERS to that situation. They relied upon, interestingly enough, a case called State Ex Rel Thomas versus Haas, which was decided in 1933, 20 years before PERS. In that case, an employee of the Bureau of Labor was earning $180 per month. Must have been a pretty high-ranking official. In the middle of March 1933, the legislature voted to reduce that one employee's salary to $172 per month, a reduction of $8. And when he got paid at the end of March, he received the lower salary for the entire month, and he sued. The court held that the salary reduction was effective on March 15th on a going forward basis, but it said that the legislature could not reduce the salary for the 2 weeks in March that the employee had already worked. That's the holding, in a nutshell, of Morrow. You can make changes to PERS that affect what employees will earn going forward, but you cannot make changes in PERS, in the PERS contract, with respect to work that has already been performed and benefits that have already been earned. This is a very significant change, and it's not without its nuances and exceptions. For example, the legislature can still change PERS statutes retroactively, as they did with some measures in the Strunk case, if the statute in question is not deemed to be a part of the PERS contract. But frankly, guessing what is part of the PERS contract is a difficult thing to do. And the legislature cannot change a PERS statute, even prospectively, if the legislature has promised that it won't change the statute. So in Strunk, for example, the court said one of the questions you have to ask is, did the legislature intend to make a contractual promise? But the second question is, did they intend also to promise that that contractual promise would never change? And the court has said that it must be very unmistakably clear that the legislature intended to promise that it would not change a contractual promise, because if you think about it, when you make that kind of a promise as a legislator, you are tying the hands of your successors, of future legislatures. With those two exceptions aside, as a rough measuring tool, the prospective-retrospective distinction is a good rule of thumb. Now, if the OSPOA court had applied the rule that the court announced in Morrow in 1996, the world of PERS likely would look very different today. Much of what was in Measure 8 would have been invalidated retrospectively, but would have been upheld prospectively, and many, many other changes could have been made prospectively in time to catch people who are now retired, who are, or people in my generation, who are tier one on the verge of retirement and have basically earned all of the benefits that they will receive. The 20-year delay in getting to the right answer has unmistakably narrowed the range of options that are available to this body to produce tangible savings. And it means that some public employees of my generation will continue to receive inflated benefits more than they bargained for, more than they had any realistic expectation of receiving, but this body's ability to take that back is extremely limited. But the Morrow ruling shines a light on the path forward. It makes it easier for your counsel and the Attorney General and other lawyers to be able to determine whether under Morrow what you're doing will be valid or not. And it also allows you to focus your attention primarily on the public policy and political challenges of PERS reform, which are weighty enough in their own right. And so even though I was on the losing end of Morrow for a big chunk of it in any case, I consider it a untimely and belated victory for the cause of PERS reform. Now, I'm happy to address any specific measures that you are considering or to answer any other questions that you may have, but I understand that you may want to hear from Mr. Hartman first, and it's my custom whenever Mr. Hartman goes after me to ask the chair to allow me time for rebuttal.
I will say yes to that right now, so there's no question about that. We're trying to have a fair and open process. Before you step down, what would folks like to do? Do we want to ask some questions now while it's fresh in your mind, or do we want to hear?
You want to wait?
I do.
Prefer to wait.
Okay. Back and forth with the questions.
Yeah. Okay, all right. So we're going to go ahead and have Mr. Hartman come up, and then we'll bring you back up for questions. I just wonder how many times you've heard each other speak. Do either of you have any sense of how many, since you've both been doing this for over 20 years?
We were joking in the hall that it would have saved a lot of time if we just played the tape from sessions ago.
Yes.
And then we could would have what the lawyers call a little pocket part in the back that updates things.
Yes.
But we didn't do that, so.
Right, well, thank you very much. That was very informative. I appreciate it. Okay, so I call Greg Hartman, attorney at Bennett, Hartman, Morris, and Kaplan, who has represented a coalition of unions, otherwise known as the PERS Coalition, and handled issues related to Oregon PERS system since 1980. And so, Mr. Hartman, thank you so much for coming to Salem again and doing this. I know
thank
that
you.
It's taking time out of your schedule to come down. So from one Oregonian to another, I appreciate you coming and informing us about what we need to know about PERS. So I will turn it over to you.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, first of all, thank you for having me. I'm always glad to come down and share some thoughts with you on whatever topic, and today happens to be PERS. Okay. And as my friend Bill pointed out, we have done this before. God knows we may do it again at some point. You never know. I did point out to Bill that we were on the same side on one of the PERS cases, and it was the OSPOA case, which the court has now thrown out as being wrongly decided, so I'll let you draw whatever conclusions you want to that particular fact. So I actually agree with a good deal of what Mr. Gary says, as I often do. We do have a somewhat different perspective, which I will share with you, and I perhaps don't share his enthusiasm for those aspects of the Morrow case, which he describes as new and enlightening and so forth and so on. So. But let me start by talking about, before we talk about the legal issues, let's talk about how do we get here. And Mr. Gary did point out that during the period of the 90s, we did have a period when the money match benefit, which had always been the primary benefit of the system, began to move higher, significantly higher than the full formula. And I think there's a slide here that Mr. Rodman shared with you, and as you can see, when you look at how benefits changed, they did go up. What the important part, though, that Mr. Gary didn't mention is, I think more fundamentally, we are here not because of this, although this contributes to the issue that you're facing, but we're here because of 2008. In 2008, the Oregon investments lost 27% or 28% of their value. So in other words, over a quarter of the assets which had been set aside to fund this system were lost. Oregon was not alone. As you all remember, those were times when around the country, pension plans, despite excellent advice in terms of investing, had very significant losses. At the end of 2007, this system was, if I remember correctly, 97% or 98% funded, setting aside the side accounts, not counting those. And so what happened in 2008 is, like so many other systems, we were devastated. And the money we had set aside, and Mr. Gary is correct, the benefits during that period of time were higher than historically had been the benefits from this system. But the money had been set aside to pay for that. That's why we were so highly funded at the end of 2007. But, you know, the more money you set aside, if you're in a market environment where you're going to lose 28% of it, the more money you lose. And so, unfortunately, it was those pension systems around the country who were very well funded who got hit hardest by the 2008 returns. Those systems, and dare I say the state of Illinois, those systems who have set aside very little money, relatively little money to pay their benefits, weren't hit nearly so hard by that because they had much less to lose. So that's part of the history of how we got here. And I'd like to share, again, these are Mr. Rodman's slides. If there's one slide that I think you need to focus on and understand, it's this slide, and for a couple of reasons. Number one, the left-hand side shows liabilities, the right-hand side shows assets, and as you can see, the retired member liability, the gray at the bottom, is very large, and when you go across the slide here to the right-hand side to look at the benefits paid or set aside to pay that benefit, that amount is relatively small. That's where almost, not all, but a great deal of the unfunded liability of this system sits with those members who are retired, those members who are inactive. Mr. Gary and I may disagree a little bit about Morrow, but the one thing which is clear under Morrow is you can't touch these people. In other words, you can't reach out and change their benefits. There's really no realistic change that I think the legislature could make which would not be deemed contractual and which would not be deemed impermissible, because after all, these people have all completed their service. They're not going to render any additional service. And so, as I understand the dynamics of this system, we have made promises. We, the state of Oregon, public employers have made promises, which the court says have to be paid. And there's nothing the legislature can do, I believe, to change that fundamental fact. So that's the starting point of any discussion. And I will circle around at the end, but before I depart from this slide, I want to call your attention to the little tiny blue part up here. You see at the top of both of those, that's the present value of the normal cost, and that is the amount that is projected to be paid for benefits on a going forward basis for all of your active members, Tier 1, Tier 2, and OPSERP. Now, you can see that is relatively small, but the target that Morrow permits you to be focused on is that blue part of this graph. And as you can see, even if you somehow could take that blue amount and move it down to pay the benefits at the bottom, I'm not suggesting that, but even if you could, it's not going to come close to paying those benefits. So again, I think this is a slide that as you think about this is one that you need to feel comfortable that you fully understand, because it tells you where we are with the system. Now, turning to the legal context for all this, I pretty much agree with Mr. Gary's characterization in terms of the law. I would go back a little farther than the Espoa case and talk about a case called Taylor against Multnomah County, which was a 1973 case. And I'm sorry to say that the same Brooklyn Bridge example for unilateral contracts was one I heard back in the prehistoric days when Bill and I attended law school. But that was the focus, that was the methodology that the court adopted as early as that Taylor case to say that pensions in the state of Oregon were contractual, they were a unilateral contract, and as Bill indicated, the way we understood a unilateral contract is you accepted it by performance and you were entitled to complete your trip across the bridge without anybody changing that promise. And I think fundamentally that's what the Taylor case decided. The Hughes case a few years later applied that same concept to PERS, saying PERS was contractual and again in the context of the same unilateral contract. Now, what makes that so important is once the court decides something is contractual, and I want to focus, we're talking here about a statutory contract. We're not talking about a collective bargaining agreement that my clients might enter into. We're not talking about any other supplemental agreements that may exist out there between management and employees. We are talking about the statutory contract, which is in ORS Chapter 238 and 238A, which was constructed by prior legislators who put those sections together. That is the statutory contract which has always been at issue in the litigation Mr. Gary and I have so ably fought over the years. And as Bill points out, much of the focus over that period of time, once we got to the point of the court adopting the unilateral contract approach, was trying to discern what exactly is the contract. Because once the court said this provision is contractual and this is what it means, the common understanding was it could not be changed either prospectively or on a going forward basis. Again, using that analogy to crossing the Brooklyn Bridge. Members who began their service with a certain pension promise were entitled to receive that promise throughout the remainder of their career. The Espoa case, the case having to do with Bill Sizemore's Measure 8, was the clearest enunciation of that principle, where the court set aside those the ballot measure, the provisions of that ballot measure, not only prospectively but for all purposes. I don't feel quite as bad about that as Bill does, but nonetheless, we agree that's the result that came out of that litigation. So. So moving forward, I want to stop before we talk about Morrow and talk a little bit about the 2003 session. The 2003 session had a number of challenges, one of which Bill has identified, and that was the challenge we saw just a moment ago of those rising money match benefits. And they met that challenge by redirecting the member contributions into what we now call the IAP account, which is essentially a savings account, a retirement savings account. But the legislature did something else. They constructed a brand new plan, OPSERP, which went into effect for those who were hired after the institution of that in 2003, and it has been the pension plan for new hires since that time. And right now, in excess of 50% of the public employees who participate in PERS are OPSERP members. So in other words, in the last however many years, what is it, 14 years, not quite 14 years, we have become a system which is predominantly an OPSERP system. Now, back then, the legislature made the determination that they wanted to have a hybrid system. In other words, rather than the system which we had, Tier 1, Tier 2, which produced a benefit, which was a monthly payment, you know, so many dollars per month for the remainder of your life, they wanted to have a system which had both the what we call the defined benefit aspect as well as a defined contribution aspect. And so they decided that the system that they wanted was, again, what I refer to as a hybrid system, one in which they directed the 6% employee contributions into that IAP account. At that time, the anticipation was that anticipation, hope, whatever word you want to use, was that account would provide about 20 to 30% of the retirement benefit for members. And that's based on the expectation of earnings and so forth and so on. Now, I want to quote one of your distinguished colleagues, who at that time was Representative Canope, who described that plan as being fair, affordable, and sustainable. And I don't have any particular disagreement with that statement as we sit here today. I may have felt a little differently back in 2003. But I think it raises the important policy question that you're ultimately going to have to address is if that system was fair, affordable, and sustainable back in 2003, what has changed? Because as Mr. Gary points out and as I will point out, any changes that you make on a going forward basis are going to fall most heavily on your OPSERP members because they're the people who still have much of their careers ahead of them. And so I think you have to ask yourself if that was a fair, affordable, and sustainable system. Does it make sense to change that system? Does it make sense to destroy that system in attempt to generate some savings to address this problem that you have of significantly higher employer rates? And, of course, you know my answer to that, but that's a policy issue. And so I think having highlighted, I will leave that, obviously, to the members of the committee to think about that and to provide whatever answer you want to on that. And I want to point out that Mr. Gary was right. The court in Morrow set aside much of the savings from the COLA changes that were made back in 2013, but they left about $900 million of COLA changes in place. And those COLA changes fall very, very heavily on your OPSERP members because, as you recall, Bill mentioned that there was a cutoff line where the COLA benefit dropped to 0.25% per year, and that was $60,000. Now, $60,000 back in 2013 was probably higher than virtually any other or higher than most retirees were getting at that time. But it was not indexed for inflation. And so as we go forward and more over time, as you know, the press of inflation and others, salaries will go up, pension benefits will go up. More and more people are going to cross that $60,000 threshold. And I think the analysis would show that that already falls very heavily on your OPSERP members. They have lost significant value on a going forward basis of what their benefits ultimately are going to be. So with that, let me turn to Morrow for just a few minutes. I think that I agree with a great deal of what Bill said. I think the one thing that he did not mention, although he mentioned it kind of in passing, was this concept of irrevocable benefits, or as the court called them, implied irrevocable benefits. Can I tell you what they are? No, I can't. Did the court give us very many clues as to what they were? No, they did not. They kind of left the door open that, frankly, I think the next court, if they care to, can go through that door and find some aspect of the system to be an implied, irrevocable part of the system. And if that is correct, then that part of the system can't be changed prospectively or on a going-forward basis. Now, where would I look for implied irrevocable benefits? I would look to the core benefits of the system. And the core benefits of the system, and this was something Strunk said back in 2004 when it was decided, or 2005, whenever, is the core benefit is the full formula. When the legislature designed the full formula in 1981, they intended that to be the benefit for the system. And so if there are irrevocable benefits to be had, they are probably going to be in those core benefits. They're not going to be on the periphery of the system where you see something which Bill and I might argue whether it's even contractual. It will be looking at those core benefits. Now, having said that, the legislature then has to ask several questions. Is there a contract? And frankly, the benefits that you're thinking about changing are very clearly contractual. I don't think that's a tough one. You have to ask yourself, are they irrevocable? And again, I wish I could give you more help on that issue, but the court really has not given us much to work with. And then finally, even if you can make those changes, you have to protect benefits based on work already performed. Now, I'm not going to go into the specifics of the bills unless you want me to, but I will point out, just as a general statement, that when I look at the $100,000 cap and the three-year, five-year changes in final average salary, the way the bills are drafted, I don't think adequately protects benefits based on work already performed. And if they were modified to do that, I think you would find a great deal of the savings which were projected by the actuaries would no longer be there. So, again, I'm happy to go into that in whatever detail you want to, either now or later or at another session. I'll leave that entirely up to you. But, again, I think there are differences of opinion in how you protect those benefits that have already been earned. So with that, I'm sorry.
Yes, Senator.
Could I ask you, Mr. Hartman, to just repeat what you said? I'm not sure that I understood it. And you were talking about your analysis of the 100,000 cap and the 3 to 5. Would you just restate what you said?
Sure. What Morrow told us is that any change which the legislature may make to a contractual benefit, assuming they may do so on a going forward basis, must protect the value of the benefits already earned. Now, in the COLA case, in the Morrow case, the COLA example, we did that by basically constructing a blended benefit. And COLA, what the court said is you worked a certain amount of your career under the old statute, you'll get the value of the old statute for that part of your career. The second part of your career, which will be under the new statute, you'll get whatever value that is. And we refer to that as the blended rate. So those people who were employed at the time that that change was made got a blended rate. Retirees got the whole 2%. People who had not yet been hired would get the latter rate. The problem with the 100,000 cap is it does not adequately protect the benefits already earned, because to do that you would have to basically modify the bill so that members who are in the system right now would have the benefit of the old statute for whatever period of their career they've already worked, let's say 50% of their career, and then you would impose the $100,000 cap on the second half of their career. But let's take someone who went past the $100,000 during their career. And since, again, that $100,000 is not indexed for inflation, lots of people are going to cross that. It's my opinion that the only way you can protect those people is to allow them to have that blended rate. In other words, if they worked half their career under the old statute, they are entitled to get a benefit at retirement based on their actual final average salary without regard to the cap for that half of their service, and then the second half of their service would be under the $100,000 cap. So that's why I'm saying that I don't think the bills as drafted adequately protect those benefits, which Morrow says you have to protect.
Thank you for your patience.
These are difficult issues, obviously, and Bill and I tend to get down in the weeds because that's what attorneys do when we argue about these things. So we'll try not to do that, but from time to time we do. So let me just summarize, if I may, and then perhaps Bill can come up and join you, and we can answer your questions, or he can have rebuttal first. One of the things that's frustrating about this, what we go through here, is we tend to talk in hundreds of millions, billions of dollars, that kind of thing, and we can't lose sight of the fact that these are people who are working for the state and local jurisdictions. And I think one of the things you have to understand is every single dollar which is saved by a legislative change is simply a dollar that's not going to be paid out in benefits. There's no magic here. There's no silver bullet. If you change something and you, quote, save money, you save that by not paying benefits. I mean, that's just as simple as I can put it. And the other thing I do want to talk about for just a minute is we tend to talk about PERSE in isolation. I mean, here we are talking about PERSE, but PERSE is part of an overall compensation package for members out there, and it's an important part of that compensation package. So as you think about this from a policy perspective, not a legal perspective, but from a policy perspective, if we so devastate our programs going forward in order to achieve some significant savings, how does that impact the ability to retain, to get people in the first place? I can tell you people are not coming to public service because of the tremendous salaries that are being paid. We all know that. But they come to public service sometimes because of a feeling that they will get a decent retirement. If we take that promise away, it's going to have a severe impact on the state, local jurisdictions. And the final thing I want to point out is that you have to understand when you think about this in the context of total compensation, active members are going to participate in curing this problem just because that's the way the system works. When they go to the bargaining table, and of course most of my clients are members of labor unions, when they go to the bargaining table, the employer is going to say, I don't have the money to give you the raise I would like to give you because I have to make payments to PERSE. And so members around the state employees, local employees, will get lower raises because of this. And ironically, of course, to the extent they have lower salaries, they will get lower retirement benefits, even if you don't do anything, because by dint of having lower salary, they will have a lower final average salary. They'll get lower benefits. So active members are part of the game, if you will. They are part of what's going to happen. They are part of the people who will have to sacrifice regardless of what you do. So, again, as you think about this, think about what's in the best interest of the state, best interest of those employees. And again, think about the fact that our public employees are already going to be part of this in any event, regardless of what you do. So let me let Mr. Gary have his rebuttal, and I'm sure both of us would be happy to answer questions.
Okay, thank you. I'll call back up. Mr. Gary.
Can I make faces? Sit here and make faces while you, is that all right with you?
Sure. You do that anyway, don't you?
Well, back there.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I don't have very much to rebut. I do feel obliged as a point of personal privilege to make one clarification. I think I heard Mr. Hartman say that I was to blame for the OSPOA decision, and before my clients start calling me up to read me the Riot Act, I should point out I was not involved in OSPOA. I represented former Governor Attia, former Governor Roberts, and a dozen or more other former public officials who sued to challenge the ballot measure 8 on the ground that it embraced more than a single subject, a case that we won in the trial court, and then the case was declared moot after the OSPOA decision. So I can't take responsibility for OSPOA, and I don't think Greg can say the same thing.
I accept that clarification.
Now, the public employers that I represent, and I dare say all public employers, are interested in two things critically. They want to be able to have the resources to provide the services that they're charged with providing. And there is just no getting around the fact that when you are paying 30 or 35% of payroll to fund retirement benefits. There are fewer teachers in the classroom, more students in every teacher's classroom, and fewer police on the streets, and fewer resources available to those officers to do their job. And when I talk about generational equity, I agree with Mr. Hartman that you have to be careful to not try to solve all of the world's problems on the back of our newest, youngest public employees. But if I were a public employee, if I were a teacher today, I wouldn't be very happy about the fact that I have 40 kids in my class because the school district can't afford to hire enough teachers to do the job. The second thing that my clients are particularly concerned about is being able to hire the best people they can find. And to do that, they have to be competitive. And they compete not only with other public sector employers, but they compete with the private sector. Mr. Hartman asked a good question. What changed since 2003 when the legislature created OPSERP? And I guess my response to that is the world changed. It's been a tough 10-year period, almost 10 years, since 2008. There haven't been a lot of raises in the public sector or the private sector. Making a living has become very difficult in the private sector, and I can tell you as an employer that it is no longer true that the private sector pays salaries that are significantly better than what public sector employers are paying. So when you look at the ability to attract and retain talent, you need to look at the entire compensation package, not just the salary and not just health care benefits or retirement benefits. And what you need to provide in order to be competitive is a retirement program that is as good or better than what is available to most people in the private sector. By that measure, it's important that you periodically take a look at the benefits that you're providing and make sure that you're making adjustments. And the good thing about the Morrow decision is that it makes it possible for you to do that. I don't have anything else other than to address any questions you might have.
Okay. Senator Johnson.
I would just like to say that I think this is one of the most thoughtful presentations that I have heard. And I think that it brings credit to the legal profession that two ferocious competitors who have been at each other in the courtroom can sit here as collegially and as willing to explain to this panel and to people listening the complexities of this system. And I appreciate deeply your willingness to come and make these thorough, thoughtful presentations on both sides.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Senator Coates.
I would like to make a comment.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't see you. Oh. Senator.
Go ahead.
Senator Sanderson.
I just had to step out to be with the city of Troutdale. And the first thing they said, they didn't know I was in a PERS meeting. You've got to do something about PERS. and so I said, well, you should sit in the hearings to see how difficult an issue this is. So anyway, I do appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Knopf.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. It's deja vu all over again for us who've dealt with the issue before. But my question really, I've got several, but one of them is I want to get your take on benefits. And let's just take a public employee. I'm sure there's none in the room, but let's just make it a firefighter.
Purely as an example.
It's just purely as an example. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of concern out there about potential changes to the system. So if I heard you both correctly, let's say that firefighter has worked for 30 years and they're concerned about whatever it is that the legislature might do. And they really wanted to work another year or two, but you know they're getting the paperwork ready because you know they're that concerned, and they're going to ship it off to PERS and retire to kind of beat the clock, as it were. So I think I heard both of you say that anything, any benefit that they've earned for those 30 years, the legislature can't touch, nor would the courts allow the legislature to touch. Is that what I heard both of you say?
There are some things around the edges that I could quibble with, but I think that is a good statement of a rule of thumb.
And I agree. And I think that, I mean, it's interesting that you say that, Senator, because every time this body takes up any PERS discussion, PERS retirements double in that year, even if you don't do anything. So, I mean, there are an enormous number of people out there who have their papers ready, and despite the fact that Mr. Gary and I may both tell them, you don't need to be concerned about the benefits, they sometimes pull the plug anyway.
Right. So, Bill, you said there might be some things around the edges. Would you be willing to identify things that you think might be pulled in if the legislature were to act on certain things?
Well, I can't think of it.
Excuse me, before you answer that, I just want to clarify, when we say around the edges, I just want to make sure that I understand and everyone following. We have different levels of expertise in the room, and we have a lot of people watching. So. Is that okay? What does around the edges mean for you, or
Madam Chair, Senator Canope, let me back up and try to be a little bit more precise. Mm-hmm. The court has said that with respect to benefits that have been earned, you can't touch them. There is an ability to make changes to certain PERS statutes that, in theory, could have an impact on the ultimate benefit earned by a PERS member, where the statute in question is not deemed to be part of the PERS contract. And in that situation, you might be able to make the change. The reason I called that around the edges is because the bottom line is going to be pretty simple. If it gets into the pocketbook of a PERS member and reduces their benefits, that will produce savings. But it probably also is going to be deemed to be a breach or an impairment of the contract. So things that you can change are going to be of a very minor nature in terms of making retrospective changes, and won't produce the kind of significant savings that I suspect everybody would like to see.
Okay, I have a question then. So I have heard more than once this reference that if something is within the contract, then it can't be changed, you know, prospectively, but things that are perhaps not within the PERS contract. Can you give us two, three, either of you, maybe one, each of you, we'll go ahead so everyone has equal here, each of you give an example of what would not be in the contract that could possibly be changed. What is this thing that people are referring? I don't have an example in front of me to know what that is.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the best example that I can think of is from the 2003 reforms. Mr. Hartman argued that the right of employees to contribute 6% toward their PERS pension was a contractual right. And so the diversion of that to the IAP was an impairment of contract. And the Supreme Court in Strunk said that's wrong. The if anything, the duty to contribute 6% toward your PERS pension is a burden, not a benefit. And in any case, they permitted the legislature to change, to redirect those contributions to a different account.
Okay. Mr. Hertz?
It's funny because that's the same example I was thinking of, because we really haven't had very many circumstances. And this will give you some sense of how finely the court parses issues, because when they dealt with this issue, and the issue was that the 6%, which had been going into the system, now went into this IAP account, they started with saying, was the promise of 6%, that narrow promise, that number six, mm-hmm. was that part of the contract, or did the legislature retain the right to change that? And they went back historically and found that in 1981 there had been changes to that number. And so they came to the conclusion that it was permissible to make that change, which is another way of saying, as Bill would put it, they found that particular aspect not to be contractual. And of course then, as a practical matter, we know that the legislature moved that 6% over to the IEP, but they found that narrow issue not to be part of the contract. So they do look very, very carefully. But we've had enough of these, and I think your efforts are probably going to be focused, as they have been, for instance, on final average salary issues, that those things are pretty clearly and unequivocally part of the contract. So if there's some marginal thing out there, I can't think of it. But I agree with Bill. It would probably not generate much in the way of savings. And all it would do would get you into a fight that you probably don't want to have.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to put both of you on the spot. Do either of you feel comfortable saying that it would not generate significant savings? Or maybe we could have Mr. Rodwin come and talk about that. This concept has been brought to my attention, and redirecting this is a topic of conversation. So I'm trying to better understand for everyone on the committee whether or not we don't want to go through an entire exercise if it's not going to generate savings.
Well, let me be clear, because I think Bill and I both talked about what happened in 2003, but what's proposed today is something far different.
Which proposal are you? Is there a specific?
I'm talking about the 6%. I understood you to be talking about the redirection of now. Taking the 6%, which is currently being paid into the IEP.
I'm going to interrupt you for one second.
Yes.
Is this one of your bills? Okay, which bill is it? 560? We're going to be hearing Senator Canope has two bills on Monday, and we're going to do a thorough discussion on that. But I just wanted, for the record, if there was a discussion about, is it 560? So Senate Bill 560, perhaps, or just the concept, because I know it's come up from more than one source, not just from Senator Canope.
Yes. So. Oh, no. It's been something that's been talked about for a couple of years.
So, just wanted to
and I just want to make clear, I don't think that the rationale that the court used in the Strunk case, in other words, to say you could do this, you could do this, and you could do this, I don't think you can necessarily reverse that and say now, based on Strunk, you can take the 6%, which is currently going into the IEP program, and put it back into a new account from which the members derive no benefit. I think that is a fundamentally different question, and so you'd have to have a different analysis. Now, Mr. Gary and I may not agree on that analysis, but I would hope we would agree that Strunk didn't address that. They addressed the opposite question.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I was beginning to be concerned that I was becoming soft in my old age because Mr. Hartman agreed with so much of what I had to say.
I think you two are going to be roommates in your retirement. You're going to be able to live without each other.
I
disagree with him, with his suggestion that there's a problem with the redirection. I think Strunk makes it fairly clear that that is something that you can do. And I didn't mean to suggest that that would not produce significant savings. It doesn't take an actuary to figure out that if you redirect 6% of payroll from the IAP to PERS, it reduces the cost to the employer by 6%. And that's true in every instance, because that's 6% that is coming in to PERS that employers don't have to contribute. 6% is a very large number as a percentage of.
But isn't that a reduction of benefits?
Isn't that a
reduction of benefits?
Yes, it's.
I don't know. I'm asking. I actually don't know. I'm asking.
It is a prospective reduction in benefits.
Okay.
We would refer to it as an unconstitutional taking. And this is why, we could have a debate on this at this point, but I think it's fair to say that Mr. Gary and I have a difference of opinion on how that would play out. And I do think it, particularly in a circumstance where you're really saying we need to move that money, not because we've made a determination that the OPSERP fair and affordable program is no longer a good program for the state, but where you're just saying we'd like to have some money to pay off our debts. Which is really what I'm hearing so far. And this is not to accuse anybody on the other side of the table of anything, but what I'm hearing people say is we have to grab this money because we have to lower benefits. And again, that's what I'm hearing out in the people who want to make changes. That's pretty troublesome from our perspective.
Okay. Did you want to say something, Senator Canope?
No, that's Senator Johnson.
Okay, Senator Johnson.
If Senator Canope wants to follow on this same reasoning, I'm happy to have him do that because I want to explore a different area.
Let's finish with this so we don't get everyone confused.
I'm done with this.
Okay, so this
was... One comment. I think it's a lot more complicated than just, gee, you want to save money. Oregon's one of the only states that I'm aware of where employees contribute nothing to their defined benefit plan. Now, it's true, even if you shifted the 6% back to PERS, that would not mean that most employees were paying that because of the employer pickup. But at least there would be a bargainable amount that members have to pay. And yes, that would be a reduction in benefits because today they get everything that PERS provides plus the IAP. But it would be a prospective reduction because, as I read the bill, it doesn't take any money out of the IAP. The IAP, from the date that it becomes, that the law takes effect, would not have more new money coming in, but that the IAP would continue to grow based upon earnings, and the 6% would be redirected back to PERS. We feel pretty confident that that is within the legislature's power to do.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. But wouldn't that theoretically be considered a 6% reduction in pay? If you did that, would you then expect an increase in the salary of the individuals? Because the benefit that individual is accruing for the work that they do after 2018 or whatever the effective date would be would yield them less to invest, whether they did it themselves or did it into the IAP.
Madam Chair, Senator Gelser, it's a reduction in total compensation. There's no question that to the extent that the employer is paying the 6% employee contribution, if that money is going into PERS rather than building on its own in a separate 401k type account, there is less total compensation being paid. But that's merely the flip side of less cost to the employer.
Correct. And follow up?
Yes, Senator Gelser.
Thank you. And I appreciate that. I'm just trying to get my mind right. I know in PERS discussions, we typically talk about the contract around that retirement benefit. But if we make a change like this, do we have issues around just the working contract for the people that are working? So would organizations need to go back and renegotiate around total compensation, or does the state through fiat of statute have the ability to just say all public employees, regardless of what your contract says, will now have total compensation that is reduced by 6%?
Let me respond in two ways. There are currently collective bargaining agreements in existence all over the state, and they make various promises. And some of them have language in them, for instance, that says if the 6% is changed, there's an increase in salary of 6%. There aren't very many of those, but there are some of them out there. If the legislature were to make a change, they may not make a change which basically impairs those collective bargaining agreements. And so, for instance, in other kinds of circumstances, in the private sector, I have seen changes where they don't go into effect until collective bargaining agreements expire or something like that to protect people's rights. But you're absolutely right. It constitutes a 6% reduction of income, whether picked up or not, because employees who have the 6% picked up have generally bargained away additional income in order to get that 6%. So you can reasonably expect that any changes that the legislature may make, which takes away income benefits from employees, they will, of course, go to the collective bargaining table and do their best to try to get those back. I mean, that's kind of the flip side of what I said, is that members will be impacted by the reality that rates are going up. But, of course, to the extent the legislature does reduce income and reduce benefits, of course, they're going to try to get that back at the collective bargaining table. I can't imagine why they wouldn't.
Thank you.
I think it's important to distinguish, though, between what is referred to as the pickup, the agreement by a public employer to pay the 6% employee contribution and the question of where that 6% goes. I think there are, I'm aware of many, many collective bargaining agreements that address the pickup, where the employer, as part of the agreement, agrees to pay the 6%. Like Mr. Hartman, I'm aware of far, far fewer that deal with the redirection issue. But he's correct that the legislature can't impair a collective bargaining agreement any more than it can impair the PERS contract. However, collective bargaining agreements are time limited, and so that would have an effect on, in some instances, perhaps, on when changes could take effect, but it wouldn't necessarily mean that they couldn't happen.
And I agree with that. Historically, people did bargain. There was a period of time when there was discussion about making the pickup illegal, or you couldn't pick things up. And so many collective bargaining agreements address that particular issue. What happens if at some point the legislature says we can't have pickup anymore? Far few of them do address this issue of moving the money from the IEP back into the system in some fashion, because relatively speaking, that's a relatively new idea. So we've not been through as many bargaining cycles when people would have raised that and attempted to get language into their agreements to protect them. There are some. I couldn't even hazard a guess. You know, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds or thousands of collective bargaining agreements out there, and they all say something different. It's fascinating.
And can I just one more? Thank you so much. And do you have a sense of who would be hit the worst by that, just in terms of that distribution across that pickup? Would that, obviously, that wouldn't be people that have already retired. Who would be most impacted?
Any change that you make, Senator, on a going forward basis is going to impact your OPSERP members most severely, because they're the people who are new in their careers. You know, they're the people who are in their first 10 years of their careers, and therefore, presumably, if they're going to work a full 30 years, they'll have 20 years to go. So if you change benefits on a going forward basis, they're the people that are going to get hit the hardest. Tier one members are at the tail end of their career. So if you change something on a going forward basis, it may have some impact on them, but it's going to be fairly marginal because they're probably out the door in a couple of years anyway. Tier two, somewhere in the middle. But, you know, my major concern, or the major concern of my clients, is that all of these potential changes have a tremendous adverse impact on OPSERP members.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Johnson?
My question changes the subject, and Mr. Rudman has already admonished me that this is not fertile ground to look for opportunities. But there seems to me to be a fundamental inequity in the inactive group. They came in, worked the contract, earned the benefit, and then departed from state service and perhaps went to lucrative careers someplace else with other retirement plans. While not working for the state, their account continued to accrue the 8%. And then they come back after the 30-year period, and while they have not been performing services on behalf of the state, have reaped the benefit of what I think is an anomalous advantage to garnering the guaranteed 8% that I'll bet you nobody in this room could find any place else. Do you see any opportunity there to find any kind of savings or adjustment going forward, or do the court cases hold those folks sacrosanct to the degree that they already earned the benefit during their period of state employment?
Senator Johnson, Madam Chair, I wrote an op-ed piece a few years back that was published in the Register Guard that compared a professor at the University of Oregon who had worked at the university for about 5 years early in his career, went to a different university out of state, ended up being a university president, and then came back and 30 years later and took his PERS retirement. And I compared the benefit that he was earning to the benefit that was being earned by a 30-year teacher in the Eugene School District who retired. The professor was receiving a significantly higher pension, significantly higher. And I my point was that is one of the anomalies about the PERS system that drives people crazy and is fundamentally unfair. I don't know whether it produces savings to address that issue, but as a matter of fairness, it just isn't right that someone who spends 5 years working for the state early in their career can earn benefits that dwarf the benefits of people that spend their entire life serving the people of Oregon. And so I think it's worth looking at. I'm not sure, I suspect that protecting the accrued benefit in that situation is going to mean that you can't really produce very significant savings. That isn't a reason not to look at it, though.
Mr. Hartman, do you have a different thought? Or
you know, I'm not going to talk about the potential unfairness because I recognize in certain circumstances the system can produce an anomalous result, which apparently was what Mr. Gary was talking about in his op-ed. But I think it's very, very clear that under Morrow, those are benefits which have already been fully earned because by definition, those individuals are no longer performing any service and therefore they're not earning any more benefits. So I think that the answer, whether any of us particularly like it or not, is I don't believe the legislature could change those benefits. I think they're already earned, and I think they'd fall into the same category as retirees.
I agree. Follow?
Yes.
I agree that let's use Mr. Gary's example, mm-hmm. the 5 years of service at the university are fully earned. Mm-hmm. No dispute about that. Mm-hmm. But this person leaves state service and goes off and has the benefit of the guaranteed 8%. He's not running into burning buildings like these people are for the benefit of the state of Oregon, but he is collecting, to my estimation, an egregious promise of an 8% contribution that is, I believe, unearnable anyplace else given its generosity. And I think that in terms of fairness and in terms of changing public opinion about the PERS system, that might be a place to look. Now, Mr. Rodman has made it pretty clear to me that well is not very deep. But I was just curious, given that you two are legal experts in this, whether or not there's any chance to do anything. Stop the 8% was my question.
Yes, and we've been down that road a couple times with the courts, and the courts have said, no, that's a promise which has to be maintained. But two other thoughts. I don't know how deep that is. I mean, are there some egregious examples of that? Maybe, you know, it's almost like the football coaches. I mean, everybody says, my God, look at that. The system's out of control. But there are always going to be those kind of egregious examples. But I do think that fundamentally the courts would say those are benefits that have been earned. The promises were made, and you simply can't change them. And the other thing is probably many of those people could retire tomorrow.
Yeah.
And well, if you were about to make a change, I would suspect they would turn those papers in pretty damn quick. So, and again, I think the well, however deep it is, could get much, much more shallow if people decided to depart the system.
One follow-up. Yes. Given that you opened the door, I will ask this question. The question of the origination of the salary in some of these anomalous cases has puzzled me. The football coach who gets a check from the university, but then it is bountifully supplemented from the athletic fund or the foundation. Or let's say a medical researcher who garners a grant to do particular work and it comes directly to the researcher. How are those calculated, and is it equitable to count these what I'm going to consider extra salary sources towards final average salary?
You know, a professor at OHSU who gets a grant, and if that grant is not paid through the university, in other words, is paid through some other mechanism, is clearly not part of final average salary for purposes of calculating PERS. Now, the example of the infamous University of Oregon coach, it's my understanding, and I've not researched this, but it's my understanding that at some point the university said to him, when you get your shoe money and you get, you know, your money from your Nike and all that, we want all of that to run through the university and to be paid out through the university. Now, assuming that that's the case, then that all becomes compensable income and all becomes part of final average salary for PERS purposes. So if I'm correct and the university did do that, I hope they understood what they were getting themselves into, because they converted what would have been outside payments into payments which counted for final average salary. No employer needs to do that if they have the kind of employee like a coach or a university professor at OHSU who has the ability to generate outside grants. Those can be kept separate. Those can be paid to those individuals, and they're not part of the compensation for the PERS system. It's my understanding.
And one last follow-up. No coaches hired after 2003. Is the situation of the coach hired after 2003 different than that, say, hired in the 80s?
Yes, actually, in 1995, the IRS placed limits upon the amount of compensation that could be considered for this. And I think it's around $265,000 these days. So you are correct. No coach, again, no matter how much their salary ends up being at the University of Oregon, or I should be fair, Oregon State, is going to see the kind of benefits that we saw paid out to Mr. Bilotti.
Thank you.
So, members of the committee, I'm going to ask Mr. Rodman, the executive director of PERS, to come up. And there's a couple of things that have been stated that I'd like to clarify. Thank you for being.
Stay.
What's that? No, you can stay. Both of you can stay.
I'm just making room.
Yeah, that's okay. So, and I just want to say a few more things before I ask questions of Mr. Rodman. Mr. Hartman, Mr. Gary, just so you know, Mr. Rodman came and gave a presentation for the last two sessions that we've had, doing a layout of where PERS is at, et cetera. In addition, for those who have not been here, for those we've also mentioned and talked about this, because this issue, if you will, has been going on for so long, that we talked about the idea that at one time there was a certain type of package of benefits, and due to collective bargaining, those packages have constantly changed. And because there are so many different bargaining units, some things that were once offered, say, in the 70s are no longer there. And there is attention being paid to that in the whole conversation. What we're doing here now, yes, we understand that there are benefits that have come and gone from packages in collective bargaining. We, as the legislative body here today, are discussing what is happening with PERS and what authority the legislature has if there's any changes that are going to be made. So just to make it clear, but thank you for coming up, Mr. Rodman. There were a couple of things. One was, we'll just start with what was just most recently discussed about the university, the coach at a university, because it was my understanding that there was a cap on the salary, and I was wondering about when benefits for the PERS kick in, et cetera. So if you could clarify that for all of us and for the folks listening, that would be great, please.
Sure. Chair Taylor, members of the committee, I'm Steve Rodman. I'm the executive director at PERS. I think if I heard right, Mr. Hartman got the dynamic correct, which is in 1995, the IRS placed a limit on how much compensation can be counted toward a benefit program, and it's currently $270,000 for 2017. It goes up incrementally with inflation. So any person first entering into PERS service after a point in time in 1995 has a limit on how much of their salary counts.
Excuse me, 1995.
1995.
Is when we set the limit.
Yes.
Okay.
So it applies generally to Tier 2 and generally does not apply to Tier 1. There's a circumstance. Small window in 1995 when a Tier 1 member would still be subject to that limit. Happened to be the former director of PERS. That's why I know about it.
Okay. And so then I had another clarifying question was, there's been discussion about people taking retirement early due to potentially this conversation or conversations that happened in past years. And I was wondering if you could explain to all of us why one would possibly be motivated or not motivated to do that, so that folks are not panicking who may be listening or something like that. So,
Chair Taylor, thank you for the opportunity. So it wasn't, again, I think as Mr. Hartman described it, that retirements double, but they do go up significantly in years when PERS is a prominent discussion in the legislature. So again, to underscore what I think both these gentlemen said, the discussions that you can have are as to prospective benefits. Mm-hmm. So retiring early will only foreclose you from gaining whatever benefit you might have gained if you continued working. You're not going to escape any sort of loss because, as these gentlemen explained, the court decisions, that there's no there's no loss you can institute that would reduce the benefits that people have earned up to date. And to Senator Johnson's point about the inactive members, as I think was already said, we haven't looked at the population, but I'm sure most of them are up to or close to retirement age. Most Tier 1 members are. So those folks are the only ones that get the guaranteed return on the accounts that they have, and those folks probably, upon hearing of this discussion, if a bill were to be introduced and start moving through the process, would start inquiring about the effect this might have on their retirement. I haven't checked with my member information center today as to the effect of these conversations, but I will bet our phone volume is up this month.
Okay. Thank
you. It just happens.
Yes, thank you, Senator Miles Anderson. And then I have something else I want to go over before folks leave the room. So,
okay.
Yes.
I just got a call from an employee of the City of Portland that has been notified. This person has worked more than 20 years, has been notified that the City of Portland is going to pay out $15,000 if they make the decision to retire by March 1st. I mean, they need to make that decision by March 1st. That they will retire. And here this poor employee is asking me, because he can't get an answer from the City of Portland, would they contact PERS, or who would they contact to find out the benefits of taking a payout of $15,000 and making this decision by March 1st?
Chair Taylor, Senator Miles Anderson. A couple of resources. One, of course, is our website, which we have what's called online member service, where a member can go in and register, and then based on the information that we have of their prior history, can run any number of scenarios for their retirement. Pick a date, pick a final salary, any number of parameters that you can enter. So that the answer for if I retired March 1, what would I get can pretty fairly be estimated for most people by going through our online services to do that. What effect that $15,000 would have actually depends on who this person is and what tier they're in, and how that and what's the nature of that payment. And we are already, as I think I've told you, the second or third most complicated system in the country. So salary ain't always salary. So a retirement incentive, if I recall correctly, a retirement incentive is not counted in your final average salary, because I think that's specifically in the statute is called out for that.
Okay. Senator Knoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question about, so we obviously know that there are certain parts of the contract that you're not going to be able to change. So the 8% assumed rate has changed over time, so clearly that's something that can be changed and isn't part of the contract itself. Is that correct?
No, it's you really have to look at this a little different. First of all, people have often referred to the 8% guarantee. There was never an 8% guarantee within the statute. The statute says that members, Tier 1 members only, not Tier 2, not OPSERP, will be paid a minimum amount in each year based on the actuarial assumption of the system. Now, for many, many years, that was 8%, and so many people began to talk about the 8% guarantee. The PERS board was always permitted to change that if they felt that, based on their expert analysis and the expert testimony they receive, that number should be changed, up or down, because it had gone up over the years. As you know, they have changed it twice in the last 4 years, going to 7.75 now. So I think that's different from the Strunk circumstance because the promise hasn't changed. The promise is you get the minimum payment based on what the system assumes as the actuarial assumption is so far as earnings. I think we've been to the Supreme Court twice on that. The court, in both cases, has said that is part of the contract, it's part of the guarantee, and can't be changed. So now, the PERS board can change it again going forward. In other words, they can say, hey, we think that based on our current analysis, 7.25 is the appropriate going forward. And that would change the amount of the guarantee that is paid to Tier 1 members. So it can change, but it's still part of a promise because the promise was not to a specific number, but to the actuarial assumption of the system.
Senator Canope, Madam Chair. I think I generally think that's correct. The promise here is the promise to pay at least the assumed rate. You could drop the assumed rate to 3%, and you would have no obligation to pay anything more than 3%. The problem is that that would spike employer contribution rates pretty dramatically. I'm not sure that you'll recall that the 2003 reforms attempted to change the 8% guarantee from an 8%, the assumed rate guarantee from an annual guarantee to a lifelong guarantee, and the court said that that wasn't permissible. Currently, there's no new money coming into PERS accounts, but if there were new money, such as if you redirected the IAP, I think it is entirely possible that you could also say, and as to that new money coming in, the assumed rate will not apply. We've also looked, without ever getting very far with it, at the question of whether PERS can adopt different assumed rates for different accounts within the system. That's another area that has some potential.
Not on that issue.
Okay. Would you like to ask a different question?
Yeah. So the retirement ages. So we have a different retirement age in Tier 1 and Tier 2. And then obviously in OPSR, we can change any part of the legislation because we, right? Because we indicated it wasn't a contract.
Well, I think you're pretty much in the same. Well, I don't think you indicated it was not a contract. I think what you said is the legislature reserves to
the right to change the contract
as long as we don't change benefits already earned.
Correct.
So arguably pretty much in the same situation as you are with Tier 1, Tier 2 because of the Morrow decision.
So would it be your interpretation then that if you were to do a, what did you call it, a blended benefit and raised the retirement age in a Tier 1 or Tier 2 system, that would be legal as long as it was a prospective blend going forward for the retirement age?
You still have the problem of what the court referred to as irrevocable benefits, but assuming those were not considered to be irrevocable, we don't know the answer to that question, then I think as long as you did a blended rate which appropriately protected benefits earned prior to the change, then I presume you could do that.
Okay.
Mr. Gary, did you have something you wanted to say about that?
I'm having a little bit of difficulty seeing how you could blend retirement age.
I do, too.
You don't retire.
I do, too. But I was just trying to figure out what you guys thought about it. So,
you know, we have really hard jobs, and Senator Canope is actually very knowledgeable on PERS, and he's, you know, we're wanting to have all these conversations in the public and wanting to talk about all the different options. And so I wanted to make certain that everyone's questions get answered. And so do you have anything else for the time being?
Nope.
Okay. The still, after all of that, you can imagine, folks, if you put yourself in my shoes, of all the people who come and tell me about things that can be done around the edges. And then that's the phrase I hear all the time. And the other phrase I hear all the time is about, it all depends on whether or not it's part of the PERS contract. And so I'm often asking people, well, what's not in the PERS contract? What is this thing that's out there that people can identify and supposedly address? And I'm not getting a lot of solid answers on what is not in the PERS contract that people can somehow change, that there would be some sort of savings within the system. So I don't know if anyone has an answer for that. It may just be a statement, but I think it's an interesting, we're kind of getting to the end of what options that may be there, it seeming like. But
part of the problem is if you take out Chapter 238 and 238A, they're very long, and they got a lot of provisions in them.
Okay.
But the provisions which deal with monetary benefits, in other words, that deal with people receiving a benefit, are those, I think, that are in most cases, and perhaps in all cases, going to be considered part of the contract. There are a lot of other things in the statute that, that may not be part of the contract, but the problem is if you have the right to change them, they're not going to save you any money.
Well, that's what I'm...
So it's kind of a circular kind of thing. I mean, I do think that when you talk about a promise, which is a monetary promise, for the most part, the court's going to find that to be contractual. There are exceptions, and Bill pointed out the exception of that 6% back in the Strunk case where the court said, no, that you kind of got that one, you know. Is there something else out there like that? I can't think of it. But I think that the problem is when you run into these kinds of issues and you are changing monetary benefits, the court's most likely to say, no, that's contractual. You've got to pay that for the work already performed. You may be able to change it going forward, but you can't just not pay it.
Okay. Mr. Hartman thank you for that. I'm going to let you have the final word, Mr. Gary, and then I'm going to tell folks what's up next in future meetings so people can plan their calendars if they're interested. So I want to be respectful. We're running a little bit over. So.
Well, I agree with what Greg said about Judge Lipscomb in the City of Eugene case described the PERS statutes as looking like an old house that has been remodeled multiple times and it doesn't quite all fit together. And that's always been my experience when I open up the Oregon revised statutes and try to make sense of it. The bottom line is there is no free lunch here. You can't find savings in PERS that don't have an impact on PERS members. You can try to mitigate that as much as possible. And I'd throw out one idea, and this is just something for you to put into the calculus and in the back of your mind. Contracts can be changed. They just can't be changed unilaterally. So Senator Moniz Anderson talked about an incentive program to try to get people to retire. You can't make people retire, but you can make it in their interest to retire. If there are savings to be had by getting people out of Tier 2 and into OPSERP or to otherwise try to hasten the process by which Tier 1 members take their leave and kind of stop accruing benefits, there are ways to do that through negotiation and agreement. And I'd encourage the committee to think about this not in terms of what are we going to do that will be resisted by PERS members, but how can we work with PERS members to find solutions that will reduce the cost and allow people voluntarily to make changes in their employment situation.
Okay. Are there any other comments? I want to leave that conversation could continue on, but we are almost 15 minutes over. Wanted to let folks know before we close that on Monday, Senator Knoop is going to be introducing two bills, Senate Bill 559 and Senate Bill 560. There is what's called the Oregon Legislative Information System. We refer to that within the building called OLIS. You can just Google the Oregon Legislature, and for those who want to look up the bill, those bills, on Monday we're going to talk about those, and I don't know all who will be here, but I'm sure the room will be full. And then on Wednesday, we're going to, on the 15th, we are going to have another conversation. One of the other things that's been brought to my attention is the discussion of refinancing the PERS costs, in other words, extending what the cost would be down the road, okay? So that's also a very intense conversation. So we're going to talk about that. We have some experts coming to discuss that. A gentleman by the name of John Scurvum, is that how you say his name? Something like that?
Scurvum,
thank you. He is the chief investment officer of the Oregon Investment Council. And so you, for those of you who have been following this Mr. Rodman has explained to us what the ongoing equation is that make up the PERS benefit, and part of it is the investment. That's the part of the equation. And so we're going to have the people who manage all the money, all the PERS dollars, and what their responsibility is. He won't be talking very long, maybe 10, 15 minutes, but in order to clarify for the public what it is that the Oregon Investment Council does and what their role is in the PERS discussion, is what their responsibilities are, I think it's an important part of it. And then on the 20th of this month, for the proposals that have been brought to our attention, we're going to be discussing those proposals, those concepts. And I think that's what we have definitely on the calendar so far. In the future meetings, we'll be able to explain what the bill numbers will be on the 20th. And some of them won't be bills. They're simply legislative concepts at this point. And we're going to be allowing those conversations to occur. So people who are interested can track that. Anything else, or did I miss anything? Okay. I really appreciate everyone coming today. It's so nice to have everyone here. And I'm going to go ahead and close our informational hearing on PERS. Our next meeting is on Monday, February 13th. We will have a public hearing on Senate Bill 559-560, first of a series of proposals concerning PERS that the committee will hear. We are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.